Hey folks, Dave Temple here with a quick message about some exciting things coming to the Thriller Zone between now and the end of the year. First of all, our upcoming guests include Robert Dagoni, Steve Urzaney, and Jack Stewart, all of whom are making a return visit in November. Then in December, we welcome New York Times bestselling author Danielle Trussoni to the podcast with her masterful thriller, The Puzzle Box. You're going to love it. As well as enjoy a visit by our good friends David McCloskey and Adam Hemdy on separate podcasts. And as we have in the past, we wrap the year with the Dave and Tammy year-end extravaganza, a surefire way to welcome in the holidays, say goodbye to this year as we welcome the new year. Finally, a quick reminder, if you have a book coming out in the new year, do yourself a favor and submit your ARCs, paper only, sooner than later, as we've been booking up about 3 months in advance. And if you have an interest in sponsoring the show, either in a big way or a small way, contact us at thethrillerzone@gmail.com and do it soon. Okay, now let's get into the Thriller Zone. The Thriller Zone welcomes Mark Graney, author of The Chaos Agent. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I think... is this a three-peat or a four-peat? I think it's a four-peat.
I feel like it's four.
Yeah.
I feel like we spent a lot of time together, David.
I was noticing in the mirror this morning, you know, between the hair kind of receding a little bit and getting grayer, I'm like, Mark's going to look at me and go, who are you? I just saw you like 4 years ago.
No, I saw you at VoucherCon in San Diego, I guess last fall.
Yeah.
And I don't think you had the facial hair then, did you?
No, I was just, I'm mixing it up, doing something different. But anyway, as I was thinking about this, I went to my hard drive and I said, oh, wait a minute, which folder? One, two, three. Oh, gee, I'm on the fourth folder for Mark. Yeah. And then I'm looking at the size of each file and I'm like, man, I've done a lot of work for that guy. I don't know where my residual check is.
All right. In the mail.
Thank you. Yeah, perfect. Dude. The Chaos Agent. We're going to spend plenty of time on this. I want to say out of the gate, and I've now read, well, you got this makes 13, right?
Yeah, Baker's, it's my 13th Gray Man.
Gray Man.
Yeah.
Baker's Dozen. And I'm thinking, all right, I wasn't there at the first, because that was several years ago. I joined you late in the game.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking back, this is the fourth book I've read. Yeah. It's my favorite one yet.
Oh, that's great. I really love hearing that, because the whole year I'm writing it, I'm thinking it's this is going to be the one where I get found out as being a fraud. So the reception to it's been really good. And that's, you know, that just totally lets a lot of tension out for me.
I can only imagine, Mark, being in your place in life, having that tension. But I've got specific reasons why. I love the slow burn out of the gate. That was a little bit different than some of your books. You sometimes come bounding out of that gate.
Right, right.
But I actually appreciated the slow burn, because it let me get inside Court's head a little bit more. We got a little bit of the dynamics of the romance side of his life.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly the reason I did it. It's like, for this story, you want to see them trying to stay the hell out of trouble at the beginning. And you can't stay the hell out of trouble at the beginning without, you know, with there being, you know, too much gunplay. Other machinations are, you know, going on. And there is some, you know, assassinations early in the book. But Court is doing his best to stay out of it for the first chunk of it. And he's unsuccessful. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been much of a book. But at the same time, yeah, that was the idea. A bit of a slow burn. The last book opened with him in a knife fight next to a bomb under 40 feet of water. So this one, yeah, I always want to do something different.
And I applaud you, Mark. I really do. And a lot of folks will say, well, dude, I read a thriller so that you can get me ripping pages out of the beginning. I'm like, trust me on this, folks. Trust me.
Yeah.
Go along for the ride.
Yeah. I try and put tension on every page. And tension doesn't always mean, you know, things blowing up and people getting killed. You know, there's tension in, you know, conversations and relationships between people and, you know, ticking clocks and all these sorts of things. I want that on every page of the book. So whether or not there, you know, I was a big Jean Le Carré fan, nobody writes slower books than John Le Carré, and maybe nobody writes more tense books than John Le Carré.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's not a backhanded compliment. That's 100% a compliment. I mean, it's magic what he does. And I don't do that. I mean, obviously my books have an element of Die Hard and Predator in them or whatever, but at the same time, you know, I also want to, you know, these are big books. So I have time to put a ton of action in and put the psychology in and these other developments that are not, you know, that are tense, but not, you know, just straight action.
And I'm not going to ruin it, but there's a scene where they're sitting on the balcony and they're trying to hide. They're trying to stay away from the action. He and his girlfriend, they're trying to, you know, blend in and trouble will find us. Let's not go looking for it. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it's the way that you craft those sentences he was mad and did. It was all the little tiny things that I've really seen this evolution of your writing to where you allow, and I hope this is a compliment, I mean it this way, the way you allow the audience to go, oh, what is he thinking with that reaction? And what is she thinking? You know, it's so good.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thank you very much. Yeah, at the beginning I wanted, so there's some tension. So Cort is in love for the first time in his life. They've had maybe the best 4 months of their life since the end of the last book. But he really feels that this is, you know, time is running out on everything going so well. It's his paranoias and, you know, it's all very well earned. And then, you know, I asked myself, if you were an assassin and you were trying to lay low and you finally let your guard down with somebody, and then you found out something they said wasn't 100% true, regardless of the reasons for it, would you immediately start building those walls right back up? And it seems like you would. So I wanted to kind of explore that a little bit at the beginning and sort of have that relationship, which seems so perfect, you know, him question a little bit, like, what's going on here?
And I, again, this is a compliment and I don't want to compare you because you're your own guy and you're your own star that's shining bright, but there's a scene in James Bond, and I'm not going to remember which one it was. It's certainly Daniel Craig near the end. It's when Vesper was involved and you saw him fall in love for the first time instead of just, you know, shag a week. And then when he found that betrayal, the way he just did a 180, and I was getting little memory hits when I was reading this similar way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Casino Royale. It's such a good movie. Yeah, and, and it's, you know, I just think about, like, if I was in that position and, you know, I have all this history and then there was something that I didn't understand that the other person said or did, I would probably just go into, you know, duck and cover mode and panic a little bit. And I think I wanted to show him doing that. I think in the first draft I actually gave to my editor and he thought I was a little too, like, he just thought people would think it was, you know, the gray man's coming off too much like a, you know, a jackass. And I toned it back a little bit and I think he was right for that. I think at first, you know, he was just literally like hitting the bricks and, you know, cussing her out or whatever. And now it's a lot more subtle and she explains herself and things move on from there. So
Tom Colgan is a good voice of reason in your ear, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. I always say that most of the editing he does, he never actually says it out loud. It's just what I can hear his voice when I write it. He would disagree. He would be like, yeah, there's still a lot of editing. There's still a lot of things I want to tweak in the writing. But this is my 24th published novel and I've done 22 of them with Tom and you know, hope to do 22 more.
Yeah. I want to circle back to him in a minute because I think the world of him, but I want to do a little bit of backup a little bit. And I want to ask what you've been up to because I want to take a step back as we come back to the Chaos Agent. And I realize it's pretty much the same with you. You're either writing a new book or inking a new Hollywood deal or tending to the wife and kids and growing gaggle of pups. Is that the same now? Is this all pretty much standard operating procedure for you?
Yeah, nothing interesting has happened. I get, you know, I'm doing a lot of this publicity and a lot of people are like, well, what do you do in your free time? And I'm going like, sit and stare at the wall, I guess, you know, have dinner, sleep. So I did two books last year. And when I say that, it's not exactly accurate because the second one, which I was trying to finish before Thanksgiving, I didn't get turned in till late January. And it's, you know, all through the holidays. I mean, I was present for Christmas Day and Thanksgiving, I guess, but all the rest of the time I was working. New Year's Eve, I was back here in my office till 10 o'clock at night. And it's just, you know, I've just been on deadline. The book just came together, the second book, not this one, Chaos Agent, but the book I have coming out in June. It just came together longer. So, you know, the last year has been tough because, you know, I used to just plop down and write 3,000 words, and it gets tougher the more you do it and the more things you've already written. You have to think up something new, and, you know, you want to keep the stories fresh. So, it, you know, to the same amount of output takes me a lot longer than it used to. And I just have so many other distractions going on in my life. So it's tougher than it used to be. It's still, once you have the book done the way you want it and you're proud of it, it's a great feeling though.
And I have to imagine, Mark, a little bit of the challenge for you is that this book was finished some time ago, already been through all the ringers it needed to go, and you're already on to the next one and even the next one. So for you to take the time to sit down with us and talk about it, I'm sure your mind does a little bit of, okay, now what was that? Oh yeah, that's right. That was that plot.
Yeah. At the beginning, when you start to do the press, you know, I have this, like, I don't think about it. I'm like, okay, I'll start on Monday or whatever. And then really closely before that, you go, okay, wait, what do you know about this book that you turned in last September or October? And then you just go, you know, like a lot of times I'll read, like, people that read the early copies of it and will write reviews. I'll read the reviews of it to see what it's about a little bit. Not that I don't know what it's about, but it's just like I've written an entire other book that takes place in West Africa. Couldn't be further from what happens here. And then I've sort of given a thin outline for the next Gray Man, the 14th Gray Man. So coming back, it's almost like coming back two books. And going back into it, I just had to refresh a lot of my memories, especially about like artificial intelligence and some of the technological themes and or ideas in the book. Right. So I spent a few hours preparing for the onslaught of questions.
Well, I'm going to jump to AI in just a second, but do you still have somewhere there in front of you your little cheat sheet? Because you said this to me a show or two ago where you said, I got a little cheat sheet just to make sure I'm, where is it?
That's not it, David. Stand by. There's more.
Oh, my God.
A little light on there just in case. And then that ought to do it. Oh, and the thing is, I don't even really look at it because looking at it's a little distracting. And so far, I haven't needed it. It's just the way that I sort of manage stress. You know, it's like if I'm fumbling for a word, I can always like go, I think it's on here somewhere. But so far, I don't really think I've had to look at it.
Yeah, if it makes you feel any better, everybody thinks that I do all this show off the top of my head, but I have an entire screen right here with all of my notes for you, so that if I ever go blank, and dude, that goes happens more and more. Yeah. I just celebrated a birthday, so I realized, oh, that's where that stuff is going.
I'd rather be prepared and not need it than not prepared and need it.
Sure, sure. And speaking of that, there's something I've always wanted to ask you, and I can't believe I've never have. And it's going to seem silly to you for a second, but the brackets around Gray Man, and I want to make sure I made a point. This started on day one, I think. And where did that come from? And whose idea was that? The little brackets.
Well, I have no idea. It's definitely the art department at Berkeley, and they're so, so good. They've really done a great job. I think what it's supposed to represent is what's called a bounding box. When you're electronic surveillance on something, it will put up like an automatic. I guess that's what it is. I'm not even sure if they know that. But every year, when like one of the most fun times of the year is when they show me the cover for my next book. And it's usually I haven't even written it. I've just sort of told my editor what it's going to be about. So they're like, you know, that's Cuba on the cover of that one. So I told them that the location was in Cuba. It involves robotics and stuff. So they went from there, and the color scheme and the everything is just amazing.
Yeah. I'm going to put this up on the screen so that it's a better picture, but this is my favorite cover to date. And you know, I'm a big fan of tasty covers. And I think it's the opposition of the colors of the purplish blue and the orange. And then you have, of course, Court hidden inside of your name, but it's, and then that drone flying by. I didn't catch that until about the third time I looked at it. And I was like, God bless America. That's a good one. All right.
Yeah.
So thank you for answering that question. I want to say, I want to reiterate for a second as we dive into it a little bit. This is easily my favorite book yet. And for so many reasons. I started off with the romance and then the way that you bring in technology. And I want to drill down on AI in our time that we've got left. And it's that slow burn and the AI influence, because that is all the rage now. You can't even turn around without hearing AI this, AI that. Well, besides the nonstop action. But I want to ask, how is the AI influencing your topic of conversation these days? And matter of fact, what's the best way to describe how it plays a role in Chaos Agent?
Well, you know, doing this press tour that I've been doing, after each interview, I kind of like self-reflect and go, man, you sound like such a Debbie Downer. You've got to bring the mood up a little bit. Because, you know, the first thing I'll say is that when I went into this and I chose artificial intelligence and these big commercial labs where the billionaires are developing the future, I, you know, kind of asked myself, you know, like, well, what do you think about this? And then the more I dug into it, the scarier it was. And, you know, it wasn't hard to find, you know, potential villains, or at least someone you could fictionalize as a villain. Writing the story is when you do all your research. You come up with an idea first. And then when you're writing, you know, I do my research while I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was just learning so much. I was getting so much information. And a lot of it's kind of scary about, you know, where things are going in the future as far as artificial intelligence. And, you know, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but you know, I keep telling myself, look, you went into this purposely looking for the dark side of artificial intelligence. So it can do a lot of really great things. So, you know, cure cancer or whatever that's on the horizon that it will do. It can also do some pretty awful things. And the way that the technology has exploded, it is it's ominous for anybody that looks at the downside of it. So I wanted to incorporate it into the story as realistically as possible. It's so important for people to understand this is not science fiction. This is all existing or emerging technology. And I really hope people will just go on Google and type in Boston Dynamics Atlas and look at the bipedal robot that's like a human that can do backflips and you can do stuff you can't do and you can't knock it down. Or, you know, the robot dogs with the 6.5 Creedmoor rifle on their backs and the hexacopter drones that can land on a rooftop and drop the robot dogs with the guns on their backs off and let them go. So, you know, there's so much out there in the world that is existing technology. And a lot of these things are remotely piloted now by a human being, but artificial intelligence is getting smarter and smarter and smarter. You know, it's aced the SATs and the bar exam. So anybody that says, you know, anybody who feels let down by ChatGPT when you ask it to write you a letter or something, it is sophisticated in other ways. And it's also in its infancy. So, you know, God knows where we're going to be in 5 years.
And to that ChatGPT reference, I think I'm safe to say that your average bear is working around in the realm of that 3.5. Well, there's a 4, 4.5, there's a 5, there's a 7 on a horizon, and it only exponentially gets smarter along the way, which is the good point and the bad point, to your point. What scared me the most, perhaps, in this story was when the drones have the ability to target, react autonomously in some way, think faster on the fly, have no emotion attached, and take out targets at an unconscionable distance. Yeah. When you start thinking about that, and back to your dropping the robot dogs and so forth, it gets scary fast.
Yeah, a lethal autonomous weapon is a weapon that's able to make its own decision on who to kill. So you have this thing called the OODA loop that everyone in the military talks about. It was invented by an Air Force pilot named John Boyd. And it's OODA, observe, orient, decide, and act. So any gunfighter, anybody in a tactical situation, anyone in a military situation knows about the OODA loop. This is how you fight. You observe something, you orient yourself to that thing, you decide what you're going to do, and then you act upon it. Well, if there's a human on the loop as like an ultimate circuit breaker, then that decide part, that OODA, the D, is handled by a human. But with artificial intelligence, they have weapons that can do it all. So the weapon's actually making the decision. You know, it's able to discriminate against targets and then say, I'm going to kill that target. And there is all sorts of, you know, everything I've read, there's so many ways that that can go wrong. Even if you programmed in the rules of war, they would still, you know, kill civilians or whatever. So it's danger and it's coming. You know, it's coming because Sun Tzu, said
art of war.
Speed. Yes. Speed is the essence of war. And so someone, let's say China, takes their humans out of the loop and they're able to fight wars at machine speed, thousands of computations a second. At that point, even though, you know, we morally and ethically have decided we're always going to keep, you know, human machine teams, as they like to say in the Defense Department,
right.
You know, the moment the other guy is able to make 2000 decisions a second with every one of their weapons platforms and everything can be cognitized. They say anything that can be electrified can be cognitized in the future. So think about that. And yeah, there's a lot to like be worried about. And, you know, the story is not a high tech story. I mean, there's this technology's involved because I think it's interesting and it's important, but you know, you don't need a mathematics degree to understand my books because I don't have one either. You know, it's an action, you know, high octane shoot 'em up, but at the same time, all this stuff is going on. And I wanted to, you know, explain it and craft it in a way that makes sense to people.
Well, I find it really interesting that so many of our mutual friends in the writing community are all up in arms when AI comes up with this. This is their very first worry. AI is going to replace us writers. And I'm like, AI will enhance your writing experience, perhaps expedite your writing experience, influence your writing experience, but the cognitive portion of it, the emotional attachment and that sense of realism can't be duplicated to quite the degree, right?
I think that's true. I also think, you know, so recently it came out that ChatGPT had culled all this information from bootleg books on Google because everybody's books, mine included, you can find them bootlegged on online. And so I can't remember how many hundreds of thousands of books that it read. And so you can go in ChatGPT and say, write a 2000 word short story in the style of Mark Graney about a man and a butterfly and a, you know, whatever, a pencil. And it's probably not gonna be that good. And the way I'm writing books, eventually I will get to that plot. So just stand by. That won't take too long. But yes, so it's definitely this thing where people in the writing community were like, oh my God, because you can see whose books were used. And I think they use like 9 of my books or 11 of my books. And people were going like, this is so unfair. We're going to sue, blah, blah, blah. And people would ask me for my opinion on it. And I kept going, yeah, this isn't the worst thing that AI is going to do to me in the future. It's like, I'd love to be up in arms about this, but frankly, I'm worried about a world ending event from all this. So I'm not going to be too fired up because it read Mission Critical or something like that.
It is funny how the fear factor, for lack of a better term, arises in some ways that you're like, dude, there are way more scary things that are on the horizon than who's going to steal your idea for a book, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Although I will say, one thing I find ironic and sort of funny is everybody thought automation and artificial intelligence would replace truck drivers, you know, store clerks, things like that. And meanwhile, it's going up at, you know, it's trying to create poetry and paintings, you know, with the generative AI, the visual stuff. Yeah. You know, it's doing all this other stuff. And it's like, wow, it's going after a different set of people that everyone sort of imagined because, you know, everybody thought by now there would be, you know, automatic trucks driving people everywhere and we wouldn't need truckers. But now it's like, it's you know, your AI is writing poetry. It's not delivering your lunch. So it's interesting how we have notions about how things are going to work and can be wrong.
Yeah. It's creating St. Bernards riding a surfboard, carrying a birthday cake.
Yeah, exactly.
In photorealism. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, spend your time there.
Yeah, I was going to say, if that's something you need, then that's something you get.
You know, one of the things I love about reading A Chaos Agent, and now, that, especially since my bromance crush on Ryan Gosling is alive and well, when you get to see him play Court Gentry in a movie, and then you say he does it so well, and you're like, oh yeah, he is Court Gentry. Then when you pick up the next book and you have him in your mind, you're like, yeah, that's my buddy Ryan. I mean, Court doing the role, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I liked him for the role because he wasn't, you know, big action star. He wasn't, you know, the Schwarzenegger of the 2020s or whatever.
Right.
And that's how I write the character. And then when I saw him perform the role, you see that the character is just like aggravated and annoyed and doesn't want to be here. And when he gets hurt, it really bugs the crap out of him that he gets hurt. And that's always how I've written him. You know, it's like, he takes a lot of battle damage, but nobody can say that, you know, I just gloss over the battle damage. You know, I have him getting stitches. I have him breaking into, you know, medical facilities and, you know, always in pain and always, you know, like trying to manage a wound while doing something else. And I thought, Gosling, and I don't know how he did it. I never talked to him about it. I did talk to the Russo brothers about, you know, how I saw the character. So he either got that from the screenplay or he got that from the pages of my book or he got that from the Russo brothers. But I mean, it couldn't have been, you know, I couldn't have crafted it better on screen than they did.
And I love that one scene. I won't spend too much time on it, but I love that one scene where he's shackled to the park bench in the middle of that square.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, really? This is going to happen? This is how, you know, that throwaway, oh, geez, and it's not like I'm a superhero. I should, and it's like, oh God, how am I going to get out of this? And I love that.
Yeah, from the beginning, I've always wanted to write him to where he's just barely getting through every single scrape. So every now and then, I'll get an email from somebody that's like, whoa, he's supposedly the best assassin in the world, and he's always almost getting killed. I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to make this story interesting. If you want to read a story where, you know, RoboCop just goes through and kicks everybody's ass and you know, nothing bad ever happens to him and he never makes it, you know, I'm sure that book's out there, but it's not really what I wanted to write from the beginning.
Yeah. Are you aware if Ryan will continue playing this, much like Matt Damon did with Jason Bourne?
That's the idea. They've written another script. Steve McFeely wrote it, one of the writers of the first Gray Man, but also had written several of the MCU films. And I met him at the premiere, talked to him for a while. And so, yeah, they've announced it. It's going to happen. They haven't announced when it's going to happen. Gosh, Ryan Gosling's only gotten like 10 times more famous in the past 2 years since it came out. So I don't know if it's a schedule thing. I know he's involved in a lot of stuff, but I hope to hear something pretty soon. And I will hear about it the same way everybody else will hear about it. The last time when it was announced on Netflix with Gosling and Chris Evans, I had not heard one thing about Chris Evans. I heard that Netflix was interested. I heard that the Russo brothers were wanting to do it. I'd heard that Gosling was circling the project, which, you know, in the 12 years it was in Hollywood, every actor you can imagine was circling the project. So it just didn't mean anything. And then it just showed up on Deadline that they were doing this $200 million movie. And I learned the same time everybody else did. And that'll probably be the case again.
See, I love these inside scoops because everybody thinks, oh, you know, Mark has his own chair on the set with his name on it. And he probably gets that. He has espressos delivered to him by hand every 22 minutes. And he's got the inside scoop on everything.
Yeah. I'm freaking out about next year's book. That's always what I'm doing. And when I'm publishing this book, I'm freaking out about what I'm doing next. So everybody that thinks, you know, I kind of have this joke with my wife that when I go to an event and, you know, meet people, I look at a room of 100 people and go, there's 10 people in here that can't wait to come up here and tell me what they want me to do with my free time, because everybody wants me to read their book or this or that. And it's like, you don't really understand. I'm not glorifying the fact I'm busy. That doesn't make me important that I'm busy. Right. It's just sort of like I'm chaotically slammed, you know, just trying to make it through my day. And people are like, yeah, you know, it'd be really great for you to start an organization of writers in the local community. And then you guys could have meetings and you could bring in. And I'm going like, yeah, you know, you come to all my signings. So two a year, 25 books in 15 years. It's like, I don't know. I don't really have time for, you know, every other thing. I get asked to read somebody's book probably 5 days a week, five times a week. And, you know, and I'm always like, are you asking me for a couple weeks of my free time? Because that's what it takes me to read a book in my free time. And, you know, I'll do it some, but 95% of the time I can't do it. And every now and then people just get mad. And then they're just like, you know, oh, I can't believe you're not giving back to the community. And I'm like, I do give back. I just can't only give back because I'm trying to write 2,000 words a day.
Yeah. And not to make it about me, but I find myself getting bombarded. I've got stacks and stacks of books.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Who want to get on the show. And listen, if I had my way, I would create an AI chip in my head to where I could just speed read every single book and then just crank out podcast after podcast. And then I get an occasional, I got one this week, a guy going, really? Dude, I've been banging on your door for a year. And I'm like, I got five people that's been banging on my door for 2 years. You know.
It's just a fact, you know, that it's like, there's just a lot going on and everybody's doing their best. And, you know, you can't really judge people. You know, like I understand people asking the question, or I'll have somebody send me an email about something. And then when I don't respond in 2 hours, they're like, oh, did I do something to offend you? And you're going like, whoa, man, I've got 60 to 80 people that are hitting me right now. And I'm doing my best.
Anyway, this is not Whiner's Corner. This is just simply, this is just little facts of life, folks. I do want to ask this. It's interesting from the writer's perspective. What do you suppose, because you've written so many books, as we've just covered, the difference and the strongest challenge, maybe that's a better way, between writing Gray Man and Tom Clancy? And I understand that they're two entirely different worlds, but I'd love to know, just from the writer's perspective, what's the strongest challenge, biggest difference between those two worlds for you, creating them?
That's a good question. I always said I never really had a trouble going back and forth between the two. They were different enough to where it felt like a different world. The Clancy books are so big and broad, and there's so many. I guess the answer to your question is, in the Clancy books, there's a certain cast of characters that sort of need to be in all the books because people want to see them. And I get that too. I'm a Clancy fan. I want to see them too. And if I picked up Mark Cameron's new book or MJ Woodard or Andrews and Wilson, the people doing Clancy now, and I picked one of those books up, I would want to see what John Clark is doing or, you know, Jack Senior is doing.
Sure.
But I made a decision in The Gray Man early on that my recurring characters, my sidekicks and, you know, second tier characters would come and go, and not, you know, I didn't have to check the box on each book to have them all in. Sure. And in the Clancy world, again, I'm not knocking it. That's exactly how you should do it. If these people are so, you know, these characters are so beloved and, you know, people have been looking at them for 30, almost 40 years, you need to have them in there. But for The Gray Man, I wanted Zoya to appear in a book and then not be in a book, and Zach to be in a book or not be in a book, depending on how I wanted that story to go. So I do hear from fans sometimes, they're like, well, there's no Zach in this book. And I think I'm thinking of the long-term health of the series, and I didn't want to get into, you know, you have this cast of characters that all need a role. I'd rather pull the characters in who worked for the story. So I think that was the big thing with the Clancy thing. It was just tough because it's like, all right, what is Dominic Caruso doing right now? And I think that it lends itself to those stories because they are big and broad. You can't have this wide group of characters, but in The Gray Man, I wanted it to be a little bit more, the camera is on Court's shoulder for the majority of the time.
Right. And you know, the person who helps keep you keeps that world in order is someone we mentioned earlier. And I want to take 60 seconds on our friend Tom Colgan, because lifetime editor of yours, practically, having spent time with him on the show, I have found him to be one of the funniest and most engaging men I've ever met.
Yeah, he's super entertaining.
He's way funnier than I ever would have expected. I don't know why. You think an editor, oh, it's nuts and bolts, young man, nuts and bolts. But then that is not the case with Tom.
Yeah.
How long have you two worked together? And you gave me a hint of it 20 books back. And what, in your opinion, so is that a check? It is. It is 20, isn't it?
22.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what, in your opinion, makes a good editor? I mean, outside of the obvious.
You know, I'm going to come at this from a very biased angle because I'm the writer. But like, to me, a good editor is somebody who's there when you need them and then lets you do your own thing. You know, Tom will trust me to try something. He'll tell me what he thinks of it once I try it. But, you know, it would be tough. I would be not as good a writer if I wrote everything in my books, you know, thinking I had to have it approved before I even tried it. So,
sure.
I have these amazing moments where I'm so confused and I'm so lost, and these books don't, I'm not just a pantser that just, you know, from day one to the next just discovers. I don't know. Do you know John Land? Great guy. I love John Land, but I was on a panel with him the other day and he was talking about how he writes, and I was like, I need that dude's brain in my head right now, because he can just pants it and write it out. And I'm like a stressor and freaking out and don't think it's good. And so I can go to Tom and be, and it's almost like, I don't even know how to ask the question, you know, because I'm so confused about something in the story, and I can work it. Tom will work it through. And it's always where I feel like I came up with the answer after talking with him, but I only came up with the answer because we were going back and forth. He's coming up with, you know, the majority of it. So I think that's the amazing skill of an editor is to have the relationship that the writer needs. And for me, you know, I need somebody to come to during freakouts, and I need somebody that's going to give me freedom to try something. And what I give him is when he comes back and says, this totally doesn't work. He wanted me to change the end of one of the Gray Man books, and I completely did not understand, but I do understand now. Not change the whole end, but just the little epilogue of where they're going next type of thing.
Sure.
And I totally got it later, but I didn't get it at the time. What I give to him is I listen to his, you know, he'll come back and be like, yeah, I think you should do this. Or, you know, I don't know that I believe this motivation or whatever. I mean, I take that stuff to heart because he only does it, you know, when he knows his stuff and he doesn't, you know, do it every paragraph. It's only when he does it, I know to sit up and pay attention.
That's the thing. There's the magic key, is being able to trust him to know that, look, he's seen it all. He's read it all.
Yeah.
So if he's going to jump in and he knows how you work, he's not going to come in and go, well, I'm just going to show you, I know what I'm doing. You know, he's going to go, all right, sparingly, I think you got something better that you can do right.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what he does. And he does it really, really well. And, you know, I turned in a book that I didn't feel comfortable with the first draft, and he read it and he came back and he's like, you know, you're worrying about nothing. It's really, really good. The pace is great. I was concerned about the pace and at different parts. And then I took that from him and I was like, all right, he's wrong. It's still a mess, but he's telling me to relax for the next draft and move on. And so I wrote another draft and now I feel good about the book. But it, you know, it's sort of like, instead of him coming back and going like, yeah, man, you're right, this is a disaster. It wasn't a disaster. I was exaggerating things, but it wasn't where it needed to be. And instead of him coming back and stating the obvious to me, you know, we've worked together for so long, he knows that I really do make changes and fix things up on subsequent drafts. So, you know, but it's nice to take the steam out of the kettle by have him going, all right, I've read it, I like it, you know, keep going.
This is one of the funniest things I have learned about you over the years, is that you, like several people who've been on the show, and you especially, for someone as talented as you are, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your skirt, But to do this volume of work, it's so funny to watch you still neurose over this when you know you've got it in the bag. And maybe actually, psychologically, that's a great thing, because if you weren't worrying, it's like the people who don't get nervous before a really big event. You go, why are you not nervous? This is really huge. Is it that you don't care? You've taken it for granted or whatever? Anyway, that's one thing I've always admired about you, and I find it so funny to this day.
Thank you. You know, I always feel like there should be a better work-life balance where, you know, I come in here just fired up and knowing that I've got this and trusting that I'll think it up on the day. And it's not like that. It's sort of like when I can't figure something out in my story, which, I mean, if you think of it, 170,000 word book, like The Chaos Agent, you're making more than 170,000 decisions. You're deciding every word you don't write. You're deciding what point of view, you know, your plot twist and all that. You're making a million decisions to write a book. And if there's something that I can't figure out, it's like, well, why would this character, you know, need this device so much that he's willing to, you know, kidnap the other guy's children for it? You know, like what's the point of that? I'll sit there and labor over that when I'm working out, when I'm walking my dogs, when I'm eating dinner, you know, I'm out at the grill, and I'll do it at the computer. And I don't trust myself that, you know, some morning I'm just going to wake up, my eyes are going to like launch open, I'd be like, Eureka. You know, that it doesn't really happen. I sort of solve things in stages after lots and lots of like tooling over it and working over it. And so, you know, I'm always happy. I'm happy with every book that I've finished, but I'm happy with none of my books when they're about 95% done, because there's so many little things that I still have to work out. So I think that keeps me humble, because I always feel like I'm about 5 minutes away from being discovered as a complete fraud.
That is so funny to me. Now, here's an interesting question. When you're sitting at the dinner table, do Allison and the kids, do they go, Mark, come back. Where'd you go? Because maybe during dinner you're working on something?
Yeah, Allison does for sure. Not so much sitting there. There'll be that thing like, what are you thinking about, a lot, you know? And it's like, I don't know what other guys are thinking about, but I, you know, I'm thinking about like, how are they going to get the bomb on that boat, you know? And that goes on all the time. There's a hilarious thing that happened to me a long time ago, and it'd been funnier if you were there. But when my nephew was really young, he's 19 now, but he was probably like 5, and he was over at my house with my brother and sister-in-law, and he had a couple of toys, and one of them was like, he had a metal Air Force One, and then he had this like black metal limousine, and he was doing this flying thing and putting one on the other. He was just playing, you know, he was 3 or 4. And my brother Trey is like, look at Mark. He's sitting there going like, wait, do that again. I like what you got there. Let's, as if I was going to take that idea of like landing, driving a car onto the back of Air Force One or vice versa. But it was funny. I mean, people can sort of see that I'm always trying to like glean stuff out of stuff.
Yeah. When Tammy and I first got together, we'd be taking road trips out to see the kids in Colorado. And it would be silent for a long time, and I'd just be sitting there driving. This is me driving, by the way. Yeah. She'd go, let me guess, working on a character? Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just wondering how he was going to break out of prison if he only had blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's so hilarious. You know, something I noticed at the end, as we're getting ready to wrap up, I noticed at your acknowledgments, this is probably the shortest acknowledgments.
Oh, that makes me sound bad. It makes me sound like I don't appreciate anyone.
No, what I'm getting at is I have read a couple of books recently where their acknowledgments were nearly a novella.
Jack Carr.
I wasn't going to say it.
No, I mean, I think it's like I read it and I'm going like, man, you've written a whole nother book. It's like I'm always so late with my acknowledgments because I'm late with the book and I'm late with my edit. You know, I'm always just scrambling. And then the acknowledgments, I've honestly forgotten to put people in there who are like real important. I'll put them in the next book that they had nothing to do with.
It's just merely an observation. There's no judgment. I mean, I just found it so interesting because I'm so glad that you named out our mutual friend, Jack Carr, because I was like, Jesus, Jack, that's an entire epilogue right there.
Yeah, he's put me in his acknowledgments. I'm like, what'd I do? You know, but no, I mean, you know, like we're friends. So
yeah, I want to ask you this. Who would you say has had perhaps the strongest influence, as you mentioned, Jack Carr, and I think of, I watch you and a bunch of your buddies on social media. Mm-hmm. What do you think's been the strongest influence on your writing career to date?
I mean, definitely Tom, my editor.
Sure,
but
sure.
As far as other writers, probably Josh Hood. I don't know if you've had him on before, but Josh and I are really good friends. We go shooting together. We're always talking about stuff. He, you know, when he's standing on a, you know, like on a bench with a noose around his neck, he calls me, and vice versa. I do the exact same thing to him. And he just read the second half of a book that I was working on that I was not happy with. And boom, just idea after idea. He's got a great mind for that. Brad Taylor is a good friend of mine, and we talk about the business and you know, like all this other stuff. And so that's also very helpful for me. I have a good relationship with everybody. There's really nobody in the industry that I don't get along with. There's people that I don't get to see enough. And then when you go to like one or two conferences a year and you're there for 4 days and you have 15 things to do and you have 50 people you want to hang out with. Josh would be the one that is like, he's given me like great ideas, and you know, we've talked through you know, like difficult things. So probably Josh.
Okay. Well, you know, you were reminding me that he was on the show once, and I need to bring him back because I did not know he was such a prolific ghostwriter as well.
Yeah. He's done ghostwriting, super smart guy, SWAT, airborne office, airborne. I guess the 101st. He's in the 82nd. I don't know. One or the other. Great guy.
All right. There's two more things I want to do before we wrap out of here, because I know you got a deadline to meet. We've done this before. You know, it's my standard closing question. I do it every single show for every author. It's best writing advice for aspiring writers. I know yours has been pretty consistent all along, but sometimes I find over the years the advice shifts a little bit. So I want to check in on Mark's best writing advice.
The best one I'll give right now is the single most important thing you need when you start a project in this genre. I can't speak to other genres, and it probably is different, is intimately know what your villain wants. I mean, I feel like I can build everything out from there. If I have, you know, an antagonist with some wants and some goals, then I can go from there. I can plug the good guy in to try and thwart the ideas. I mean, obviously characters are super important, because if people don't care about the characters, then you're completely dead in the water. But the initial thing, like if I was sitting down, I've never written a book, I was sitting down, I wanted to write, I can write, but I have no plans for a book. I would be like, who's my bad guy and what do they want? Or honestly, what do they want? And then I'll figure out who it is. Once you have that initial thing, you can expand on that and expand on it and expand on it. And eventually you have a story. For Chaos Agent, I was looking at people like Elon Musk, you know, these multi-billionaires that have these massive AI labs, and the Defense Department wants to work with them. And, you know, Chinese wants to steal their material or, you know, create their own versions of things. And I just thought, wow, that this nexus between, you know, business and ego and greed and ambition and military's necessities and all the money that's involved, it's like, wow, that's so rife for trouble. It's like, well, what if some entity had developed an artificial intelligence agent that was able to be completely weaponized as a almost like an intelligence agency? It's attached to offshore banks, so it can buy people and order things and ship things and you know, socially engineer people. And I just thought, like, wow, that's like an incredible device. Now, how does my hero factor into it? And you know, you expand from there, and you turn this initial kernel of an idea, which was, you know, that's, you could write that in a paragraph, and you turn that into a 170,000 word book 6 months later.
Folks, did you hear that? There's a little masterclass for you. Nicely done.
Thanks.
All right. Only because it's you, and I kind of have stopped doing this because attention spans are shortening, but you know that thing I do, random fire questions? Mm-hmm. I got three of them real fast. Yep. Kind of funny. I want you to play with me, will you? All right, here you go. Number one, you've been asked to compete with Jack Carr, Don Bentley, and Brad Taylor in a shooting contest. Who of the four will perform the best, and who's going to come in last?
Brad Taylor will come in first. Jack Carr would be right there. I would come in last. Bentley would probably shoot better than me, although he's an officer. There are people joke that officers that can't shoot, but I'm not an officer. They also joke about people who aren't officers who can't shoot. So, I would handle the weapon safely. I would hit my target. I would do everything right. I would just do it at a glacial pace.
Okay.
Because that's how I am. So I think okay. Brad or Jack would win, one or the other. And then Don would be right behind him. And then I'd bring up the rear.
Okay. Fair enough. Number two, you've just learned that part of a future film deal hinges on your performing in a scene as part of your former hard rock band, Bad English. Will you A, play drums like you did in the 80s, B, sing as lead vocalist, or say no freaking way and pass on the entire deal?
I'd play drums, and hopefully they have some good CGI or whatever special effects, because I can't play like I used to. I have a drum set now, and it's always frustrating because it's like, God, I used to be so good at it, and it just feels foreign to me. But, oh my God, I'd love to do that. I need something done with the hair. I guess they could handle that.
Which leads me to number three, addendum. You lose a bet with your wife, Allison, and she asks you to grow your hair long again, complete with perm. You lose the bet. Yes or no?
Yeah, it's like my stepkids. It's the funniest thing in the world. When they see me wearing like makeup and long hair and a perm, they just die laughing. Like they send it to their friends, you know. And I'm like, hey, laugh all you want, but in 1987, that worked. You know, that was working for me. golly, no, there's no way. I would do a perm again. I don't care. I'd have to pay her in jewelry or something.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I am going to be featuring the photograph that I have of you.
You have one? That's fine. I can laugh at myself. And again, I will say in 87, I was doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Sporting the do.
Yeah.
Love it. All right. Well, folks, the book, of course, again, is The Chaos Agent. And the website, if you want to learn more, markgraneybooks.com. Mark, as always, just a thorough pleasure.
Well, it's great to see you, David. Thank you for having me back. Hopefully we can do it again.
I'm expecting to see you around cranking out books for decades to come, brother.
I hope so. Thanks a lot. Your front row seat to the best.